The hour is 1:40. The date is 12 May 1983, and the place is room 124 of the Judiciary Hearing Room, located within the Capitol Building at Kewan, Alaska. Members of the committee present for the hearing today are Representative Malone, Representative Hayes, Representative Liska, and myself, Representative Bussell. Matters at issue before the committee today are House Bill 326, Act Amending and Repealing Provisions of the Alaska Exemption Act, House Bill 323, an act claiming residency and residency requirements providing for an effective date, House Bill 281, an act relating to payment of wages, House Bill 94, an act relating to seizure of items used in any aid of fish and game violations. As we have a number of people who wish to make a statement on House Bill 281, and some of those are rather high-powered officials of the state who wish to get back to their duties as soon as possible, we'd like to deal with House Bill 281 as the first order of business today. And Jeff Berry is here to make a statement on behalf of the sponsor of the bill. And at this time, Jeff, if you'd join the table. Jeff, since we are recording electronically, I need you to state your name for the record prior to making a statement. Seven.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jefferson B. Berry, B-A-R-R-Y, professional aide for the House Labor and Commerce Committee. The House Labor and Commerce Committee has recommended a committee substitute before you. And that is in Section 3. This is an equity bill, in essence, and the provision that the Labor and Commerce Committee would request be inserted is an equity provision also. In the current law, there is an exemption under the overtime provision for nonprofit hospital employees. There's a long history as to the fact that there were no profit hospitals. It was brought to the attention through testimony before the committee that there is currently for-profit hospitals, and it was creating a hardship on both management and employees. The Department of Labor initially objected. The committee at that time took not only public testimony, but contacted the employees affected, the employers affected, and requested the Department of Labor to do so independently. They did so, and at this time, everyone concurs in the bill. Both management and the employees would request that it is to their benefit on the whole to include this provision. And if there's any questions in the bill, I'd be happy to answer them otherwise.
Are there questions of the committee members? Mr. Berry, if not, Jim Robinson, Commissioner of Labor, and Dennis DeWitt are both here to make a statement too. At this time, the Commissioner could make a statement. Appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman,
electronic. Can you state your name for the record?
Jim Robinson with the Department of Labor. And maybe I'll take that provision that Jeff talked about first. We did make an independent telephone poll on it, and the majority of those people that we contacted were in favor of this amendment. The other portion of the bill, we think that gives us the flexibility to not impose the penalty when the guy doesn't get his pay within that 3-day period. Also, in the second section of it, we're hopeful that if there's amount of wages that they both can agree on, the guy will just go ahead and pay those, and then if there's any problem with any outstanding amounts, then the employee has the right to take whatever action he needs. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Questions of the Commissioner? If not, thank you, Commissioner. And Dennis DeWitt is here for the Alaska State Hospital Association.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Dennis DeWitt with the Alaska State Hospital Association. We support the provisions, have nothing more to add.
Okay. I have a couple questions.
Sorry, I came in late. As the chairman knows, I was here before. I haven't had an explanation of Section 3. Would you explain that to me?
Yes. Yes, to echo Mr. Berry's testimony, there was a long history of not-for-profit hospitals in Alaska that were covered by this section. This is an exemption to the overtime provision, primarily so that in the nursing division, you can use what's called a back-to-back work week for a 14-day work period, working 10 of the 14 days, the work period. The main purpose of this is to allow nurses every other weekend off. It's something that is strongly supported. There was an investigation by the Department of Labor. There was a teleconference by the Labor and Commerce Committee wherein they spoke with nurses at Humana who were under this program prior to the purchase of Alaska Hospital by Humana, a for-profit corporation. This is simply an attempt to return them to their previous status so that, in fact, as you well know, my wife is a nurse, and it really delights the family to have them home every other weekend. And that's essentially what it is. There is no opposition. There was some concern initially, but the Department of Labor, as Commissioner Robinson indicated, has resolved his concern or satisfied that it simply is taking care of a problem in the law that no one was aware of when the purchase was made. It has disrupted the employee pattern to Humana Hospital.
Has the there is a nurses association in the state, isn't there?
Yes, there is.
Have they testified on this?
To my knowledge, they have not. However, nurses at Humana Hospital were polled. And the only facility that would be affected by this are those nurses at Humana Hospital. So it's really it's to correct a problem created simply by change of ownership. This is the current state throughout this state, throughout the nation. It is not unique, it's not new. If there was a quirk in our law, then it is simply correct that quirk.
Thank you.
Further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further witnesses who wish to make a statement. Committee substitute House Bill number 281.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I'd just like to ask, and I apologize, I popped out for just a minute. If I can ask a question, maybe if
Mr. Barry.
Commissioner.
Yeah. Commissioner Clark.
Well, okay, if Mr. Barry can answer. I'm just trying to determine the effect of Section 1. And maybe you already said that in your testimony, and for that I apologize to the committee. Would you explain the effect of Section 1?
As the law currently stands, there is no way that the Department of Labor can waive what is perceived as late pay. And it creates an inequity not to have that flexibility of waiver. What happens is if employers have remote sites and an employee terminates and says, I'll pick up the check in town, they then don't go to town, or 2 weeks later they come in to pick up their check, and because there's no postmark or documentation to show that they attempted delivery, the employer then is subject to 2 weeks worth of wages, and employees have abused that. There is no discretionary ability in those cases of where the employer has in fact made a good faith effort to pay on time. They have mailed the check, it was a bad address, whether it was given to them by the employee, and it's to allow the department the flexibility in those cases where it can be shown that the employer did in fact attempt to make payment, that they not be penalized with the full amount of wages for whatever period of time until the employee did get the check. It's a discretionary clause.
Mr. Chairman? The language would also allow an employer to simply refuse to pay and avoid the penalty if the department backed him up. Is that right? There's no standard for the exercise of the discretion. That's what I'm trying to determine.
Within the Fair Labor Standards Act, there is similar types of provisions as to what constitutes good faith. And I believe that the Alaskan courts have consistently ruled in areas of where there have been case body flaw that those standards, while not applied word for word, are applied in those situations.
So are you saying there is a good faith requirement here?
The good faith or the reasonable quality that if there were acts of God, if mail did not get delivered on a certain day, that those types of provisions certainly would demonstrate.
If the Department of Labor under this, if this bill passed, and the Department of Labor adopted a regulation which said that basically, let's say that in all circumstances, the employer need not pay within 6 working days of termination. Would that be a proper exercise of the discretion here?
In my readings of the rulings, the laws, the case body, no, it would not. However, if you want to go to extremes in any circumstances, the Department of Labor could refuse to take any case that was brought to them, period. I mean, it's getting a little bit far afield. I think the history of the Department of Labor is very good in this field, in this area. And what they are saying is that they have developed a pattern, particularly involving remote sites, where there is a centralized payroll office, of not having the ability to equitably address the legitimate concerns of both an employer and employee when it's a one-sided sword, that the only finding they could make was that the pay was late and therefore a penalty is assessed.
I understand that. We've solved that problem. The one I'm concerned about, you've given a better hypothetical than I have. A determination by the Department of Labor that it's going to never exercise its discretion to impose a penalty. That's legally possible.
It's legally possible now?
No, it isn't. If the employer violates, the whole problem. They're saying it's too rigid now. If the employer violates subsection B, he is liable, period. You're giving total discretion, which under perhaps another administration would give the Department of Labor power to decide they're never going to enforce this section. Do you disagree with it as a possibility?
I would disagree with the ability to enforce that in a court of law.
If I disagree with your interpretation.
If you're going to use the postage machine to establish it, you can crank in a postage machine and run it through. You can get all kinds of hypotheticals for documentation for attempting to pay. It's ridiculous.
Well, that's one of the problems, and I will again use the example that we're concerned about administrative agencies having too much discretion and what we didn't quite intend for them to do. We're giving them basically total discretion to reinterpret the three-day requirement any way they want. I don't have any problem with solving the immediate situation, but it seems a little broad, that's all. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have one question here on line 10 here, underscored for the new wording, an employer may be required. Doesn't sound right to me. May or shall are two different words.
Right.
Otherwise, may.
Okay.
Are we putting enough teeth into this?
I think that's the precise word that I'm concerned about. The decision is up to the Department of Labor. They may require them to pay the penalty, or they may not. And that's exactly my concern. In all situations, not just the one raised by.
Opinion of the Department of Labor, opinion of the affected agency, it seems to be fine.
If I were the Department of Labor, I'd want this discretion too. I don't have any.
Are there further witnesses present to give the state this bill? Not, this is a committee of second referral. It has been heard in Labor and Commerce. There are 3-0 fiscal notes along with a letter for the governor accompanying this bill.
Mr. Chairman, I move and ask unanimous consent committee substitute for House Bill number 281, Labor and Commerce. An act relating to the payment of wages be moved from the committee and ask unanimous consent.
Yes. Objection.
Individual recommendation.
There being none, committee substitute the House Bill 281, Labor and Commerce, an act relating to the payment of overtime pay is moved from the committee and individual recommendation.
Charlie, would you like some help?
That was one of my better days.
I'll help if you'd like.
We just, why don't you explain 294?
94.
Or I mean, Hospital 94.
Chairman, would it be possible to ask if you expect to get this in 26 years?
It's going to be awful late if we do.
Maybe we'd prefer not to give any of them take off or be.
Chances of speeding through their letter, you hope to work with the residency department first.
Appreciate sorry to interrupt.
Don't you, what we've done with 294 would change to.
My name is Steve Kramer, and I'm assistant to legislative aide Kelly Bessel, House Judiciary Committee. What the committee has before each of them is a committee substitute for House Bill 94. Per recommendation by the Department of Law, and the two changes that you'll notice in the committee substitute. Yes, the work draft is marked by Hine, and the date is May 11th, 1983. And the changes are underlined, and they begin on page 1, line 15, relating to the seizure of items. And we've added, if the person making the seizure determines that the seizure is necessary to preserve an item as evidence of a violation, and the additional language that we put in was to prevent the removal of an item from the judicial district in which the violation occurred. And the similar language is carried over on page 2. Line 7, the same thought is carried forward. Again, we stated that the item is evidence of the violation for which it was seized, or that there is reason to believe that the owner or custodian of the item will remove it from the judicial district in which the violation occurred. I noticed Gail here earlier, but she may have stepped out. Right. And they are, per the recommendations following our last meeting earlier in the week.
We need a motion.
Mr. Chairman, we're working on 511 draft, right?
Yes.
I would move we adopt the 511 draft as a CS for HB 94.
Objection. There being none, 511 draft come before us to this special. I'm getting terrified.
You want me to help?
Yeah, can you? I guess it's calling all here.
Why don't you give me your sheet, Charlie?
We've adopted this draft for discussion. It embodies all the language that we had agreed to.
You got the signing sheet there? And you voted on the draft. And we have now Lieutenant Conrad, Civil Department of Public Safety.
Madam Chairman?
Mr. Chairman's fine enough, but I'll help him.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Conrad Seibel, S-E-I-B-E-L, with the Department of Public Safety. And you've heard from us before, basically what we've said is that we're in opposition to any changes in this particular statute. I won't go into all that again, rehash that all again, but I would like to comment on a couple of the new changes in the draft here. And we're looking for a misrescue right now, and some of the more legal questions she could probably answer. But a couple concerns is on page 1, line 17, where it speaks to about the removal of an item from the judicial district in which the violation occurred. There's some concern there that sometimes an equipment is seized outside the judicial district from which the violation occurred. And would this possibly cause us any problems here? We feel like perhaps the wording is affected by the state would be more appropriate. Our concern is that if we have a violation that occurred in one judicial district and we seize an aircraft in another, how would that work with the wording? The other concern that we had was on page.
Did you want to accommodate
Do you want me to interrupt, or did I?
Representative Clarkson.
Something way beyond me there. Would you give the page and line reference?
Page 1, and starting on line 17. It speaks here, or to prevent the removal of an item from the judicial district in which a violation occurred.
Same thing on page 2.
Yeah. Correct.
And your concern is that the procedure in moving an item from one judicial district to another isn't clear.
I'm concerned, when I saw this a few minutes ago, I'm concerned that we may seize or set an aircraft that is in another judicial district other than where the violation occurred. And that's our concern. Okay, they've already moved it out of the judicial district.
Representative Clarkson, does that answer your question?
At least I understand what he's saying. No. Okay.
It appears to us that there might be a problem.
You may continue.
The other on page 2.
Just to make sure I understand, what you're talking about is the concern where a violation occurs in the first judicial district, you catch the guy in the second judicial district and seize his airplane there.
Correct.
Sure. He's got a point. That's not what's intended, I think. The whole point of that was to keep the plane from being taken out of the state.
Representative Liska.
Thank you. That's what my understanding was in all the testimony we had on here. We didn't want to have an airplane that was seized and before they could determine a court decision on it, the individual moved the airplane clear out of the state to California someplace. Now, do you mean, Mr. Label, that that's not addressed right here to your satisfaction? Well, he moved one judicial district to another, he really shouldn't enter too much. But we don't want it going out of the state, that's the one thing that we definitely do not want, right?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. We do not want leaving out of the state. I'm concerned, and maybe Mr. Esker could address it, but answer the question, but I'm concerned that he sees an aircraft in another judicial district other than when the violation occurred. This only speaks to where the violation occurred.
And Steve has a comment he wishes to make.
I believe, but Gail's back now. I was going to say that being out of the state is synonymous with being out of the judicial district at the same time, isn't it?
Well, that covers the one situation, but his situation is still a problem.
Representative Malone?
I concur with Representative Clarkson.
You may continue.
Mr. Chairman, on the bottom of page 1, line 28, if the owner of an item, continuing on page 2, line 1, seized under a regulation of the department, obviously the item is necessary for the owner's livelihood. We have a problem here when we start talking about the livelihood and who establishes, the owner establishes that he needs the item for his livelihood to whom? The court, to the local Fish and Wildlife Protection officer who seizes the item, or to whom?
The chairman says the judge decides.
I just want to agree. We've been over and over this, and that was the discussion. I think that was the intent. I thought we were going to see some different language to clarify it. As I understood the situation, you get the item back if you satisfy one. Satisfy the condition, first of all, that it's necessary for your livelihood, and secondly, it's not necessary as evidence, and it's not going to be removed from the jurisdiction. And that's, a court does that. That's what we've done.
Representative Malone?
It's a little off point, but I'll bring it up now, come back to it. You should have owner, the word owner in there, but I'll come back to that. Because I can see a case, if you're talking about livelihood, where somebody's got a fishing boat leased, or whatever it happens to be the same thing, but they wouldn't be doing it. But back on this point here, I'll follow that first.
Mr. Chairman, on line 3 and 4, we see that the wording, unless forfeited by the order of the court, has been removed. And we're concerned that perhaps with that wording being removed, it may, the state may lose some authority in being able to forfeit certain items to the court. And Mr. Reskin might be able to speak to that later, but we're concerned there that we do not want to lose that by statute. And then the final final item is that we still feel that this draft does not allow for continuing seizure of items for continuing violations. And if I may, one of the things that came out of the Alaska Judicial Council Subcommittee on Fish and Game Sentencing was that the people out in the state, one of the end results of the hearings throughout the state, testimony indicated that the sentences in fish and game cases are and have been far too lenient to be effective. We're talking about sentencing here, we're talking about seizure on this bill, but we feel that we do not want anything to lose the effectiveness of enforcing of the state's fish and game regulations. And we feel that any changes to this statute would do that.
Further questions of the witness? There being none, thank you very much.
I assume you continue your opposition or concern about the 7-day provision.
That's correct.
Join us at the table, please. For the record.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, my name is Gail Horetsky. I'm with the Criminal Division, Department of Law.
You may continue.
Thank you. The additional language in the bill was added by me at the committee's request, and the changed language appears on line 17 on page 1 and the similar language lines 8 and 9 on page 2. I hope I made it clear. I attempted to state it the other time I had testified that in the opinion of the Department of Law, this bill is a bad idea. It would actually work to the detriment of our enforcement effort in fish and game laws, and that I would be willing to drop the language that the committee suggested, but that it wouldn't remove most of our major objections to the bill, and that's true. With that introduction, if there are questions about that language, I'd be glad to answer. Representative Claxton made a comment, Madam Chair, if I may, that he had expected that we were going to see some different language about the guide proofs to the court in Midwest Standard. If that was your understanding, I'm sorry, sir, I didn't understand. I had heard with Mr. Kramer, and I thought I was clear that was the only change that had been requested by the committee.
Yeah, I'm not sure of that. I just know we discussed it, and there was some question about how it was worded.
I agree that the way it's worded now, it doesn't answer those questions, and that if it's going to be passed, perhaps it ought to be changed that way, but there are several other changes that I believe ought to be made as well, and I think I was, in fact, instructed by the committee not to make other changes, but just to confine myself to that, so that's what I tried to do.
Gail, would you just comment on the question of the judicial district that...
Yes, Madam. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd be glad to. As originally drafted, I had the language prevent the removal from the state, and that is what we had talked about, as Representative Liska indicated. The problem occurred to me, though, for example, what if the person were involved in a fishing violation and a vessel were seized, for example, in Nome or on the North Coast? It seems to me that if the person wanted to take the boat and move it from Nome down to the Aleutian Chain or to Southeast or something like that, the terms of what we had here would not prevent him moving that boat or that plane or whatever all around the state. And when it came time for trial, if fish and game people needed that piece of equipment or ultimately after conviction wanted to forfeit it, that we would have then the burden and the possibility, if we could even do it, of trying to figure out where is the boat now, who's got it, is it in the state, can we go seize it again to forfeit it, and all of that stuff. So what I figured is if we seized it in Nome, it would stay in Nome until the judge said, yes, go ahead, move it to Cold Bay, but tell me if you move it anywhere else. And I was envisioning a court order to allow it to move beyond we have, of course, 4 districts in the state. That's a policy matter, and I think if you took out judicial district and put in state, that you would accomplish your main goal. You'd still have the problem of moving it all around the state, but at least you would prevent them from taking it to Texas, for example.
Further questions?
No.
Thank you.
Much pleasure, you know, you move this bill out today.
Need a motion to adopt the committee substitute.
Already.
This is a new committee substitute.
Absolutely right.
This is a new committee substitute.
I think he did it.
Do I need a motion to approve the committee substitute?
Mr. Hayes.
Thank you.
Representative Hayes, I'm confused.
I think Representative Martin's, I move and ask unanimous consent that the Judiciary Committee substitute for House Bill 94 be moved from the Judiciary Committee with individual recommendations.
Is there objection?
Have we adopted this yet?
Yes.
That was the first one. There being no objections, so ordered.
So they didn't fix the judicial district?
Well, you took the policy.
Yeah.
Pardon me.
Yes.
Get a minute, bring that up on the floor.
All right.
I'll take care of it.
Next order of business, 3-2-3. Patrick interrupts and see. Does he have?
Next bill before the committee today is committee substitute for House Bill 3-2-3. Judiciary, an act relating to residency and residency requirements provided for an effective date. We have one person signed up, Bob Maynard from the Department of Law.
Madam Chairman, Mr. Chairman, my name is Robert Maynard. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law. Today I'm testifying both on behalf of Representative Abood, who apologizes for having another committee hearing, and on behalf of the Department of Law. House Bill 323 has had extensive hearings in the State Affairs Committee. I have some brief introductory comments, and I would be pleased to answer questions after that concerning the bill. My brief comments will be in three areas: the reason for the bill, a short description of the bill itself, and some requested amendments, both from Representative Abood and from the Department of Law, to take care of problems that arose that were discovered after the bill had passed out of the State Affairs Committee.
Mr. Mayor, could I ask you a question so that we're all sure. Reading from the same sheet of music?
Sure.
We have a CS for House Bill 323 State Affairs, and we have CS for House Bill 323 Judiciary. Which will you be addressing your remarks to, please?
I will be addressing my remarks to the CS by the Judiciary Committee.
Thank you.
What are these?
Those are the amendments that you said you proposed.
Oh, these are a lot of amendments.
Right. Briefly, the bill is an attempt to clean up a number of provisions of the statutes which raise constitutional problems in the wake of a number of recent court decisions. The two constitutional problems, and they are separate problems, one is an equal protection problem, and one is a problem of the U.S. Constitution and privileges and immunities. The equal protection problem is probably the more well-known. That is the question of whether or not you can use length of residency as a basis for distinguishing between residents for those purposes of getting acquisition to a program. For example, a residency requirement, a five-year residency requirement to be eligible for veterans loans, similar residency requirements. Residency as a means of sorting out those people who you believe to be bona fide residents from those who are not. If that is the purpose of the residency requirement, it is our belief that it, except for two limited cases, that 1 year is the extreme to which you can go to use residency as a basis for qualification for a program. This bill, in a number of instances, changes the residency requirements from in excess of 1 year down to 1 year, and it also has a provision that says, sets out a general residency requirement in Section 1 that will apply in the absence of a residency requirement in a particular statute. The second constitutional problem is a problem under the U.S. Constitution under privileges and immunities. That problem is that although there are some instances when a state can grant rights or privileges to only its own residents, to only its own citizens, where there is something that's called a fundamental right, like the right to earn a living, you can't limit things to only your own citizens. And one of those that has recently been made very clear by both the U.S. Supreme Court and the Alaska Supreme Court is the right to earn a living, the right to a license, the right to a bar, you know, an attorney certificate, a right to a plumber certificate, whatever it may be. In our statute, there were a number of statutes which provided that in order to be entitled to a license or to the right to practice a profession, you had to be a resident. Those are unconstitutional, and this bill cleans up those provisions. The bill itself is, the structure of the bill is that in Section 1 of the bill, it sets out a standard residency definition. And it is a minimum. It basically requires 30 days in the state and the intent to remain. The standard definition of residency is that you are actually here, and secondly, that you intend to be in Alaska. That section then says that particular portions of the statutes may have longer residency requirements by statute. And the rest of the bill on those sections that deal with the residency requirement set out those longer one-year provisions. Since this bill passed out of state affairs, there were a number of pretty minor problems, but since this is a cleanup statute, we had discovered a few other problems that would be appropriately in this bill, and we believe should, and we would request this committee to put them in. I have discussed these amendments with Representative Abood's staff, and they are in agreement with them. And they are somewhat self-explanatory. Basically, what they do is they take out the term resident where resident is still there. In one instance, there was a definition of residency where the residency definition had been eliminated. The only one that really requires some discussion is Section 8 of, I'm pretty sure, the new House bill is inconsistent with another bill that is now winding its way through the legislature, and that is now in House Finance, the Fisherman Loan Bill, and it is inconsistent with House Bill 302. Whichever way this committee wishes to go with Section 8, it should be made consistent with Section 6 of HB 302. So either Section 6 of HB 302 should be changed to meet this particular bill, or this Section 8 should be made consistent. We would recommend that Section 8 be made consistent with Section 6 of HB 302, but whatever is done, those two should be made consistent. I would be pleased to answer questions and continue on.
Mr. Chairman, is there anything in this piece of legislation or the proposed amendments that would in any way affect the questions that have been raised about residency requirements for, say, the longevity bonus, perhaps a pioneer home? There was a piece of legislation which has already passed the House and been signed into law by the governor dealing with the Fisherman's Loan Program, so a two-year residency requirements, some other conditions, and so forth. Is that, would the passage of this bill in any way compromise or adversely or positively affect anything we might be doing with, say, the longevity bonus question?
Mr. Chairman? This bill does not address a few limited questions, such as the ones you raised. It does not address the longevity bonus program, which has been left to I think Senator Ray is the one spearheading that effort for the Legislative Council. It does not address the student loan program, since that program has, one, there are other provisions dealing with the student loan program, other bills in both the House and the Senate dealing with that, and plus it is a matter of litigation at this point. It does not address pioneers' homes, and because it does not address pioneers' homes. I think those are the three. And it does not address the legislation that's already passed with the Fisherman Loan.
Then for every other program,
loan program or whatever, it does address that. Essentially says that a resident is a person who's stayed 30 days and indicates intent, proof of intent. Is that what it is?
Correct. And the rest of the bill deals with other parts of the statutes and other particular programs where it increases that residency requirement to up to 1 year. I would mention that the two programs we do believe the two-year requirement is defensible is in the student loan program and the fisherman loan program. But this bill doesn't deal with it.
I'd like to follow up, Mr. Chairman. Do you have any opinion on longevity bonus or since you have one on student loan fishing?
Longevity bonus program is also a matter of litigation, and a temporary settlement has been made with legislative council and is in this discussion. It would be very difficult to defend longevity bonus program. We are not saying that it would be totally indefensible, but it would be tough to have a good faith defense for that particular program.
Judiciary Committee substitute and the proposed amendments, in your view, would be the maximum residency requirement that we could maintain under any type of constitutional challenge. I believe I heard you say that. And are we getting any when we take out student loans, longevity, pioneers, and fishing? And we take the Judiciary Committee substitute as a 30-day requirement. Are we picking up much of a fiscal note? Are we opening up any programs that it certainly would be if it applied to longevity bonus or pioneers or student loans? That would have a tremendous financial impact. But is there anything we're missing? Is there anything there that any programs that would fall under that 30 days that would adverse financial impact upon the state general fund?
Mr. Chairman, to my knowledge, no. Again, this was a bill that was done in State Affairs Committee. The Department of Law on this bill was brought in rather late on that. We haven't been independent, but my knowledge, my understanding is no, that this does not affect open up loan programs, for example, the more recipients, or open up any grant programs.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a copy in my file.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question in regard to this 055 residency. Now, this bill is only addressing a few items here: real estate brokers and military personnel or ex-military applying for loans and things like that. 055, we end up addressing residency. I don't think we can get around that. So is it in your line of thinking, Bob, that that we will have to address other particular pieces of legislation addressing, for example, the permanent fund dividend program right now? See, we have down here on line 23 on page 1, that the absence of a person to establish or claim residency in another state is one of the requirements that they could not receive a loan or the permanent fund dividend program. We've got literally thousands of people right now tied up, can't get their dividend program checked because they own homes in a state up here, and according to the way this wording here, person who establishes residency in the state remains a resident during an absence from the state unless during the absence the person established or claims residency in another state. Mm-hmm. You see what I'm getting at?
Yeah.
I mean, they're not paying the permanent fund dividend program right now, 2,000 people live there. I know, because I'm checking on them all the time over there, because I get so many calls over there. So this piece of legislation is really, unless we address that particular subject, another piece of legislation. You see where I'm coming from? Correct. Can you address that, sir?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. The section, there is already an existence of the Permanent Fund Dividend Program, other definitions of residency for that program. Section 1 will apply only to those statutes. In other programs, like the Permanent Fund Dividend Program, there is are separate and additional requirements for residency, like I think it's a 6-month residency requirement in the Permanent Fund Dividend Program, with particular provisions about people being outside the state. Section 1 of this bill does not apply, therefore, okay, to the Permanent Fund Dividend Program, because there are separate and additional requirements in that program. This is Section 1 is seen basically as a catch-all, and it basically sets out the standard legal definition of residency in the absence of a statute or other legislative enactment defining residency requirements for that particular program. So your concern is correct, but I believe that in the Permanent Fund Dividend Program, there is a statute in effect already that changes basically set the Section 1 standard to something different for that program.
Well, a couple of questions. First on that is, I think that we do have a different standard of residency for that program that you're talking about, which is 6 months, and then there's certain other items that, like if you're outside the state, you're in a sort of proof situation. Standard proof is a little higher than what would be here. But I think the main difference is it is 6 months, and proof requirements are probably, I guess you say, since they're specific, they must be higher. But I had another question about something that's not contained in the bill, and that is, well, we had this case settled, Gilman v. Martin, on the land disposal parcels, but we don't have any litigation pending right now on the Pioneers one, right?
We do not.
Okay. I don't think we have any legislation pending on that either, my knowledge.
No, there isn't.
We could probably, I guess what I would say to Mr. Chairman is I think that you probably anticipate some in that area. I don't know what exactly to do about fiscal motives. It's a big ticket item, but I don't know if that particular section of the statutes has a non-severability clause built into it or not. But if it does, something we might want to look at in committee for item separate legislation. If it does, I think the impacts of the program being declared under equal protection or privileges, immunities, whatever, is being off bounds could be more serious than the longevity bonus program.
Mr. Maynard, would you care to comment?
Hey, Mr. Chair, the problem with the Pioneers Homes is that the residency portion of that particular program is so intertwined with the nature of the program itself that it would be extremely difficult to change the residency requirement and still have a Pioneers Home program. So whether or not there's a severability or a non-severability clause in that program already, if you make it a non-severability clause, you open it up to everybody. It's just an entirely different program. That is one reason why it's not addressed in this bill, and I'm not positive a non-severability clause or a severability clause would help much, because it is,
you know, well, Mr. Chairman, I'm not suggesting we put it in the bill. Okay. I'm just saying that if the residency requirements and the duration residency requirements in that program were found by the court to be something that was unconstitutional, then I think the impacts there might be greater than in the longevity bonus program, where you do have loss of income.
Further comments, Representative Hoffman?
Several questions. I'm sort of going through this chart, and I assume the notations following the title are the actions taken in this proposed legislation. Do you have that chart?
I don't have it.
Let me just show you. If you go through here, does this...
Yeah, the chart is a copy of a chart made by the Department of Law about 6 months ago, and the things in parentheses were added by the State Affairs Committee, and I think by Susan Berkowitz, the special counsel, as to what they did.
Okay, I have a few questions. Let me ask, let me go back to the privileges and immunities first. If I understand what you are saying, and this is reflected, I think, in the proposed judiciary substitute, under the privileges and immunities argument, if one of those essential items or fundamental rights exists, you may not have any durational requirement. Is that correct? Correct. So in those cases, even 30 days is too long.
Correct.
And that's the basis of the bar membership decision and others. And that's why you're eliminating resident in any of the entitlement programs.
Correct.
Okay, I got that straight. As to, there's no reference in here to fishing and hunting fees and the fact that the fees are substantially different for residents and non-residents.
Correct.
Can you speak to why that is?
There is a line of cases by the U.S. Supreme Court. I think Baldwin is one of them. Baldwin v. Minnesota, I can't put off the top of my head, that does seem to allow a state to charge different fees for residents and non-residents for fishing and hunting and things of that nature. And until the court changes its ruling on that, and whether or not that's consistent with everything else they've ever done, until the court changes that ruling, we believe that the law of the land.
In our statute, how is resident defined for purposes of that differentiation?
I think 1 year. I think 6 months or 1 year, one of the two. I can't, off the top of my head, I don't know.
Okay. I haven't read Baldwin lately, but do you think that we are comfortable under both the equal protection and privileges and immunities argument as to differing fees for natural resources?
Clearly, with regard to prison movement, because of the right to hunt and fish for sport is not a fundamental right. For equal protection, I think it's clear too, because the idea is the problem is that there is no problem with the state saying we are going to give rights only to our citizens and like for loan programs for things that the state owns. I mean, the question always is which ones are our citizens and which ones aren't. How do you sort out those people who are just off the boat and here to visit from those who are get off the boat and say I'm going to stay. I'm an Alaskan. Mm-hmm. One is a bona fide resident, one is not. Both have the same objective, you know, present the same objective view to people. And you've got to find some way to distinguish between those two. And one way to do it, and one permissible way, is by a durational residence requirement. The idea that if you've been here for 6 months or a year, we will tend to believe it's more likely than not you intend to stay, you intend to be an Alaskan. Even though there may be people less than 6 months or less than 1 year, who do intend to be an Alaskan, who do intend to make this home, who are bona fide residents, who are being cut out of all these rights. That's your equal protection problem, that you are sweeping in by your straight test. You're excluding people who really are the type of people you want, and the question is how broadly are you doing that? There is not much question that you can say, okay, look, we believe that for hunting and fishing rights, you know, we want to give some additional benefit to our own people. It's not a fundamental right for privileges and immunities, so therefore we can do some discrimination here, just not total. So I think it's all right, even under a more advanced view of the law. And at the very least, it's extremely defensible. We would not recommend changing the law solely in anticipation of an adverse court ruling. The rest of these changes are in anticipation that we would have a tough time defending these in court. That one we would think we'd have a good chance of winning.
On the question of guides, there are several guide licensing provisions, which have substantial requirements which could be interpreted to be residency requirements. You have simply repealed those provisions, even though some of them, as the chart indicates, are simply requirements of 20 years experience in the guide district. Are you as comfortable that it's necessary to completely eliminate those, or simply in the repealers, to completely repeal those provisions, leaving no way to assure that our guides are experienced in Alaskan conditions?
It's my understanding that the requirement of experience in the guide district for Class A assistant guide is not changing. It was the residency requirement for a registered guide that was deleted, and our resident requirement for a simple residency one. I agree with your comment.
You and I agree. I misread this, I guess. You deleted the residency requirement, but not deleted the requirement of 20 years experience.
That's correct.
And the same with the master guide. You have not deleted the 10-year experience. Okay. It's possible, of course, that we could, rather than simply repeal the residency requirement for a registered guide, impose some less strict experience requirement and perhaps make it defensible.
Well, I think the residency requirement in that particular statute was that they had to be a resident of the state of Alaska, and it was not a durational of 10 years or whatever.
And since that's a profession, the argument is privileges and immunities. If a person could show they live in Germany but have hunted in the Yukon Customer area for 20 years.
Germany might be a different matter. Minnesota.
Minnesota.
And came up here for 20 years, they could do it. They get the guidelines.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? There being none, thank you very much. We have four things we need to do. The first one we need to do is to adopt the Judiciary Committee substitute. The chair would entertain a motion. Representative Hayes.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I move and ask unanimous consent that the State Affairs Committee substitute for House Bill 323, the Judiciary Committee substitute for House Bill 323 be adopted.
Thank you.
And I ask unanimous consent.
Is there objection? There being none, so ordered. The next thing we need to do, we have an amendment, Mark A. Chair would entertain a motion to adopt this amendment.
I shall move, Mr. Chairman.
I ask unanimous consent.
I would like to hear comments on the amendment by law.
Mr. Maynard, would you come back?
We'll run through it briefly.
The two pages, the blank pages, they are not numbered as to. The first one deletes the minor one. The present statute has a provision for a temporary certificate and allows you a temporary certificate if you meet everything except the residence requirement. Well, we're deleting the residency requirement in the first place, so you can't. There's no longer required. So it's just a cleanup when a residency requirement was deleted. The next one call somebody a resident trainee. Delete the quote resident part of the trainee. That's a profession. We can't require residency. That's a very minor one too. And the third one basically is in the same statute concerning embalmers, and it defined the resident trainee as being somebody. Since the statute would now call the person just a simple trainee. It's just a parallel to AS 42. The repealer of AS 0824 is there are one-year residency requirements. Okay, 08-24-110 is a one-year residence requirement for collection agency operators, licenses, et cetera. That was just skipped over. Again, that is a profession. Under privileges and immunities, we can't require them to be residents. And so that repeals that. The next one, on the guide licensing, we have repealed the, in the community substitute, the guide licensing repeals the requirement that somebody is a resident. OS 0854 defines what a resident is. Since we're no longer requiring somebody to be a resident, the definition is superfluous, and that is a cleanup amendment also. The AS 2610080 deals with a veteran's burial allowance. It was a program passed in 1981. When we made the chart, we overlooked that. It wasn't. It was an overlooking, and it was. And the veteran's burial allowance requires a 5 years residency requirement to be entitled to the veteran's burial allowance. That is the same problem with the veteran's loans of requiring 5 years and should be deleted to make it just a one-year residency requirement for all veterans. Section 8, again, Section 6 of House Bill 302 deals with the same problem as Section 8 in House Bill 323. Section 6 deletes the residency requirement for veterans' interest rates. We think that the two should be compatible. They both apparently are on their way to being passed, and the two bills should be made consistent. And we would recommend that you basically follow the language of Section 6 of House Bill, or the deletions mentioned in Section 6 House Bill 302. Dave.
Is there a question?
On the last one, you went too fast. I don't have House Bill 302 here. This is Section 8 of the Judiciary Committee Substitute we're talking about, right?
I can get my copy of the Judiciary Substitute.
Lines 5 and 6.
Correct.
And so that leaves for that program a one-year residency requirement. What does 302 do?
302, basically for both, these both deal with AS 1856-101-1. The Section 6, and basically right now, the statute provides that to be eligible for veterans' interest rates, you must have been a resident for at least 1 year before your induction. And then came back for 1 year after discharge, or if you weren't a veteran at the time that you were inducted, that you be a resident for 5 years after you come back, and at least for 1 year before you apply for the loan. The problem with that is for a regular interest rate, for a regular loan program, this is the additional veterans interest rate for the loan program, there's no requirement to be a resident for your regular loan, the AHSC loans. What Section 6 of House Bill 302 does is deletes both the requirement, you know, both halves of the test. This basically deletes the second half of the existing test.
Representative Malone?
You know, I think we need the specific language that we want to put in there.
Deletes A and B. Yes, it deletes, basically it would be AS 1856-101 A, 101-1A and B are deleted.
Let me just ask, are you absolutely convinced as a legal matter?
5 years, yes.
About the requirement that the 1 year immediately before induction and 1 year after discharge.
The Attorney General's office has an opinion saying that it is unconstitutional. Whether or not I am absolutely convinced that that is undefensible is different than that.
But the recommendation of the Department of Law is to repeal both residency requirements.
Yes.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I incorporate that in the motion. We have a pin down.
Is there further discussion on the motion?
Yeah, I was just going to say, technically it's 1856-101 sub 1 A and B and sub 2 A.
Further discussion? Did you ask for unanimous consent?
Ask for unanimous consent.
Is there objection? There being none, so ordered. The next thing we need to do, now that we've adopted that, is we need to move the bill from committee with four fiscal notes, the one new one, the highest judiciary fiscal note from the Division of Fish and Game. Representative Hayes.
Madam Chair, I move and ask unanimous consent that Judiciary Committee substitute for House Bill 323 as amended by the Judiciary in the Judiciary Committee, along with four fiscal notes, be moved from the Judiciary Committee with individual recommendations.
Is there objection?
Object.
Representative Malone.
Thank you. I don't really object to the motion or to moving the bill, but I made got this amendment, one of incorporated the law proposed, one of which we don't exactly have written down yet. Okay. Well, we've got written down another bill. So what I'm saying, my point is we don't, maybe don't have any objection to the motion, but I think we should have a clean bill before we actually take the action to sign out the bill, just on general principle here that don't have a slip on it.
Representative Hayes.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I generally agree, except it's that time of year, and in order to, this is one of the only bills we want to get on the House floor, and
it has to
finance. It's a practical matter. It has to go on to finance, where it will be subject to further review, and for that reason, although I agree with Representative Malone conceptually and in spirit, I would not be inclined to withdraw the motion.
Representative Malone.
Yeah. Well, I'll withdraw my objection. I think the name.
Thank you, Representative Malone. Yeah. There being no further objection, committee substitute for House Bill 323, Judiciary Amendment will be moved from the committee with individual recommendations.
Madam Chair, and I'd like to point out that that we have, to the extent possible, try not to make this a matter of procedure in this committee. The record, Representative Malone's, that I don't particularly like to do this as a matter of course.
Representative Malone.
I don't know who's raising this first. Well, I'm not. I appreciate the explanation by the speaker. I guess my point is that if we're going to sign the bill report right now, it's fine. I'm not going to sign it. I think we should have a clean bill going out of committee, even though it does have another committee referral. I seriously doubt finance is going to deal with substantial issues in the bill or with specific amendments. And maybe I'm wrong on that, but that's still my point. Thank you.
Further discussion?
I realize we already have a motion on the bill. I'm reviewing the fiscal note on the from Fish and Game or revenue. I guess revenue prepares these ID cards for
the senior citizen, fishing licenses that we deal with in here, they request a January 1, 84 effective date on that portion of the bill, the reason being that they issue those things for a calendar year, and apparently they're concerned about some confusion in the middle of the year. I realize we've moved the bill, but maybe that could be brought up in finance. I mean, you can't change the effective date for that one provision. You've got an immediate effective date on the rest of it, so you need the votes anyway.
See, we already have another bill someplace striking those out.
Dealt with it in resources.
We dealt with it in resources.
Okay. I only got to strike that section of the bill, but that's okay. Will this bill be printed up or prepared tomorrow so we can sign the committee report? I think you've been trying to go to church yesterday.
Yeah.
To help us
thank you all for being so cooperative.
Yeah.
Is that